Let's hear from this week's Great Life. Miriam Makeba, born in 1932 in Johannesburg, South Africa, where I was born, died less than a year ago. Known across the world as Mama Africa, she was a legendary singer and outspoken voice against apartheid. Miriam Makeba was the first performing artist ever to come out of South Africa and gain worldwide fame. But she was exiled for 30 years from her homeland, only returning to South Africa in 1990 when Nelson Mandela was released from prison. So let me introduce this week's guest, Kate Humble, whose choice Miriam Makeba is. Kate, you've been bouncing around in your chair during that. This is a favourite song of yours, isn't it?
I don't know how anyone could sit still and not smile while listening to the Patter Patter song. It's, to me, it epitomises everything that is wonderful about Africa. It also epitomises everything that I admired so much about Miriam Makeba, a woman of just fantastic spirit, irrepressible spirit, really, against a regime and a life that often was desperately hard, both personal tragedy and of course the political situation that she found herself embroiled in. And anyone who can instill that sort of joy, I think it deserves to be celebrated.
Irrepressible.
She is irrepressible. And as I say, that song is Miriam Makeba in a package, really.
Kate Humble's career grew, you might say, from a sort of gap year overland trip all down Africa from Cape to Cairo, from hatching crocodiles to driving and cooking for safari companies. Her first journalism came from Africa, but since then she's travelled almost everywhere. Then came television. I could mention Animal Hospital. I could mention her journey through the Sahara with a salt-carrying camel caravan, her work reporting for Country File and with Rolf Harris. She's done presenting for Animal Park and Top Gear, City Hospital and a whole range of science and wildlife programmes, from Tomorrow's World to The Essential Guide to Rocks. 6 series of Rough Science 2. She's broadcast from the bottom of the sea, she's a scuba diver as well, and swum with sharks. In short, I'd say, one of life's communicators of exploration. What first introduced you to Miriam Makeba's music, Kate?
It was that first journey to Africa. I met somebody when I was doing a typing course in Oxford, a South African girl, and this was in the late 80s. And there weren't very, I mean, now, you know, everyone you bump into almost is a South African. But then there weren't very many South Africans coming to Britain. And I met this wonderful girl, Giggs, and we talked about her homeland. And I started falling in love with it. And she said, "You really must come. You'll love it. You'll just love South Africa." And it, you know, in the 80s, of course, South Africa was a deeply unpopular country and certainly wasn't a place that anyone went on their gap years. They went to Australia or the States. And I thought, I really want to go. And part of it was rebelling against my parents, who, of course, were horrified at the idea because they thought it was unsafe. And also rebelling against all those other students who were kind of marching against apartheid without really knowing what it was. And I knew nothing. I was 19. I was absolutely ignorant. But somehow, something made me think, I want to go there and I want to see it for myself. I want to try and understand what's going on there. And it was an extraordinary journey. I've never, ever regretted it. I've never regretted going to apartheid South Africa. It's one of the most important things I did. And I spent a lot of time in the townships, in Alexandra outside Johannesburg, in Guguletu, in Khayelitsha outside Cape Town. And I met black South Africans. And I thought, as a white person, I wouldn't be allowed to, or that they wouldn't speak to me. And, of course, the opposite was true. I was welcomed by that incredible African hospitality that I've experienced so much over my life. And that's when I first heard Miriam Makeba's music. And it summed up that time, and it summed up everything that needed to happen to South Africa to let this country blossom. And it was a really interesting time, because although P.W. Botha was still in power, you got this feeling, even as a sort of totally naive 19-year-old, that things were beginning to shift, and there were a lot of white South Africans who were fighting against apartheid. We marched in Cape Town, you know, me and white South Africans and black South Africans. We marched, we got tear gassed, we got chased by South African police dogs. But there was this feeling of this has got to end, and it's got to end soon. As I say, it was a very exciting time, and the music kind of seemed to be the backdrop to it.
Absolutely. Makeba was in a way part of all that and part of that feeling. Let's bring in our expert biographer, Nomsa Mwamuka, who joins us on the line from Johannesburg. A long-standing friend and colleague of Makeba's, Nomsa worked with her on her autobiography. Nomsa, how did you come to know Miriam Makeba?
Miriam Makeba, I actually call her Mama, or called her Mama Makeba for the time that I knew her. For her age, I guess, but also just for her impact. You know, she didn't become Mama Africa for nothing. She was just larger than life. I first met Miriam Makeba when I was very young, obviously through her music. You know, like many people growing up in exile, Miriam Makeba was like, you know, the soundtrack for our lives. You know, she sang freedom, and the only way we could really identify with South Africa and what was going on back home, the only connection we had. So I knew her all my life, basically, I could say. But I met her personally in 2000, and from 2000 was fortunate to have spent almost every other day, just to have spent a lot of time with her.
This will have been on her return to South Africa after her 30-year exile. How was she finding it, and how was South Africa finding her?
She came back to South Africa in 1990. That was her first time back home after 30 years in exile. So I think for her there was still a lot of, it was home, but always a bit of displacement at having lived in so many different places around the world. And people sort of identified with a Miriam Makeba in exile and not quite a Miriam Makeba at home. So she continued traveling, and the short time she got to spend at home, you know, possibly was never enough. She spent, you know, the rest, her years, even after returning home, on the road and traveling with her music and with her work, and probably still got, she got definitely got more work internationally than she did in South Africa.
Her life as a singer is threaded through her career-long campaign against apartheid, the two of them intertwined together. Did she, Nomsa, think of herself as political? Did she think of herself as in any way a politician? What would you call her songs political?
A lot of her songs were, like Pata Pata, not quite political, but they were political in the sense of what she connected them to. Before each song, she would always speak about where she came from.
Tell us
or
about
the conditions in South Africa.
Tell us about where she came from. She had very humble beginnings, I think.
Miriam was brought up in a township called Prospect Township, outside Pretoria, slightly north of Johannesburg. And a family of six children that wasn't a very well-off family. Her mother was a domestic worker most of her life.
And also a healer, wasn't she?
A traditional healer. Yes, she was a traditional healer. But it wasn't a family with much. So Miriam Makeba as well only did her first year or two of high school and worked as a domestic worker before she was discovered, so to speak, and started singing professionally.
Her father was from the Xhosa tribe, I think, and her mother was Swazi, is that right? What language did she speak, Xhosa or Siswati?
A combination of both,
yeah.
But definitely more Siswati because of her mother being there. Her father died when she was very young. She was only 6 years old when her father died.
She says that she spent, from the age of about 3 weeks, she spent 6 months in prison with her mother because her mother was brewing beer and it was illegal to brew beer, and so mother and baby were thrown into jail. What a way to start your life in prison.
I know, and that was always her joke, that she was a jail baby from day one. So anything else that was, you know, going to happen to in her life, you know, was dated back to that.
And the singing, I guess, started in church and in school?
Yes, singing started in church and in school, but also from a family that sang. She always said her mother sang very well, and her brothers and sisters sang.
Did you know, Kate, that she had a baby at 17 and her first husband left her shortly afterwards?
I know, and I think the outcome for that baby was yet another tragedy in her life. I think she grew up and died in childbirth herself, so it was a terribly sad story. And I think this is one of the things that makes me admire Miriam, and actually she epitomizes a lot of African women for me. Please correct me if you think this is an over sentimentalization by an English woman who just fell in love with Africa, but you know, African women have a pretty rum deal a lot of the time, and I think it's extraordinary that somebody like Miriam, and as I say, she happens to be famous, but there are a lot of African women out there who have overcome extraordinary difficulties in their life, extraordinary poverty. And then with apartheid on top, and yet they come out singing, whether really or metaphorically.
Yes, no, I totally agree with you. I think a lot of what Miriam had on stage or in her public life or was able to share were stories of a lot of people who probably weren't fortunate enough to get out. You know, a lot of African women who didn't have opportunities, or people who had opportunities but made the most out of them.
I was looking at a film about her, and she was explaining how at the same time as trying to develop a singing career, she was working, she was doing domestic work, she was working as a nanny, and she was working as a washerwoman. And she talked about being a black nanny of white children and how the children often felt closer at first to the black nanny than to their own mothers. Well, when I was born in Johannesburg, I had a black nanny called Maggie. She was Zulu, and my mother says that she used to strap me to her back and she used to sing as she did the housework, and that it was the only thing that stopped me crying. My own mother couldn't stop me crying, but Maggie could stop me crying. And you know, Maggie could have been another Miriam McCabe if she'd had the opportunities.
The opportunities. I think so. I think there are a lot of people still, I mean, which is sad to talk about it in 2009, a lot of people who still don't have those opportunities. But knowing that things were possible for a Miriam Makeba, yes, she had her, you know, talent, her voice to take her places. But I think for a lot of people, what has come out of her life is that anything is possible.
All the biography that I've read suggests that it was in a film which was made in South Africa and smuggled out of South Africa that her voice and her performances first became known. But I remember, and we were living in what was then Southern Rhodesia at that time, I remember a musical, a fantastic musical called King Kong. And I remember her singing Back of the Moon in a way that I will never, ever forget. That this isn't mentioned so much, but it was quite big at the time, wasn't it, Nomsa, King Kong?
Yes, no, King Kong was massive for the time because it was the first all-black production. It was like breaking all the rules that was allowed to be performed for mixed audiences. So it was a bit underground, but, you know, people... It was 1958, 59. Mama Makeba had been performing since 1952, but largely in the townships. So King Kong was really like, you know, Miriam Makeba opened up to the rest of society.
What were the circumstances of her leaving South Africa for the first time?
Miriam Makeba left South Africa in 1959 because she was working on King Kong at the time, but there was an American film director who came into South Africa and did an underground documentary about apartheid. The documentary was called Come Back Africa. The filmmaker, Lionel Rogerson, managed to get his film into the Venice Film Festival, and the festival organizers, I guess, liked Miriam or what she represented at the time, because she only had a 2-minute role in the film. She just she was just in the documentary film to sing 2 songs.
Yeah, which she did sing beautifully, I must say.
She sang beautifully, yeah. And she was invited to the festival.
But she ended up, didn't she, Kate, really going stratospheric in America.
Oh, I think they loved her, didn't they, Nomsa? I mean, did she sing at John F. Kennedy's birthday, is that right? With Marilyn Monroe, or at the same, not probably with her. I can't imagine that duet.
How was it that she came to speak at the United Nations General Assembly? Tell me.
She was invited. The first time she spoke at the United Nations was in 1963. She had been in America since 1959, 1960. And she was making a name and getting a lot of attention. ANC leaders in exile approached her and said, and asked if she could use her popularity or whatever, you know, she was getting a lot of media attention, why she couldn't use that to draw attention to the cause in South Africa. So that first speech at the United Nations was written for her. It wasn't written by her. But just the fact that she agreed to read it and to condemn apartheid, I mean, that definitely set her on a path to what would be her life of activism.
We have that recording here.
Wow. Wow.
I ask you and all the leaders of the world, would you act differently? Would you keep silent and do nothing if you were in our place? Would you not resist if you were allowed no rights in your own country because the color of your skin is different to that of the rulers? And if you were punished for even asking for equality? I appeal to you and through you to all the countries of the world to do everything you can to stop the coming tragedy.
This is BBC Radio 4, and you're listening to Great Lives, where my guest, Kate Humble, has chosen the life of the South African singer Miriam Makeba, Mama Africa. Our expert witness is Makeba's co-biographer, Nomsa Mwamuka. Did she try to return to South Africa at all during that 30 years?
Only in the early years of her life, when she first got there, 1960. Her mother passed away while she was in the States.
And sent her daughter, Miriam's daughter, out to America to be with Miriam when she knew that she was dying,
She knew she was dying, yes. It's one of those tragedies, yes. Like, you know, within weeks of her daughter making it to America, Miriam's mother had died. So she tried to return to South Africa then, and her passport was basically revoked. She travelled into Africa a few times after that and formed very good relationships with African leaders. Another amazing thing about her life is that when African leaders knew that she didn't have a South African passport to travel on anymore, she was given honorary passports by 9 countries.
Sekou Touré, who was, I think, the president of Guinea at the time, proposed to her. In fact, she went through, was it 4 husbands or 5 in the end? I mean, her husbands looked like a kind of slideshow of the march of emerging black consciousness, if we take them one after the other. Tell us about her husbands.
Her husbands. Again, I think that's Miriam Makeba being individualistic and living her life as she could or wanted to. The first husband was a South African man, didn't have a very good relationship with him. He was the father of her only child. So after that first marriage failed, she married a musician called Shuna Pillay, who was an Indian Durban-born man. And I always wondered how she got away with it at a time when South Africa, the Immorality Act, was you couldn't even have relationships across a racial divide. But she got married to Shuna Pillay. That didn't last very long either. Then her marriage to Hugh Masekela when she was in America. Stokely Carmichael, that was really, I think, at the height of her activism. Yeah. Stokely Carmichael, and then her last husband, who she was with in Guinea in the 80s.
Was she a difficult woman, Kate, do you think, at this time? I mean, it can't be a coincidence. To lose 2 or 3 husbands may be regarded as a coincidence. But
I suspect none of them could live up to her.
Thank you.
I don't know. It's as I say, I never had the privilege of meeting her. But I imagine that somebody who came from the background that she came from, effectively without a father, because her father died when she was so young. So, and an African society, again, Nomsa, you please disagree with me if you think I'm wrong, but is actually quite matriarchal. I mean, we tend to think in when you're not in Africa, of Africa being run by a succession of fairly hopeless men, if I may say so. But actually, behind the scenes, whether it's politically or, and certainly in family life, it's women who do rule the roost. And thank goodness they do, otherwise the continent would be in a really terrible state if they didn't. But I suspect that Miriam Makeba was and had to be an extremely strong, independent, singular-minded woman. And that can be hard to be married to.
Yes, no, definitely. I agree with you. She was working from when she was a teenager, so she was independent. She was already a mother at 17, so she had those different responsibilities, and she had a career. And before she married any of her husbands, she was Miriam Makeba with a name. So I guess living up to that, I laugh in one of her books. One of her husbands feeling very offended that he was referred to as Mr. Makeba.
She did get kind of tangled up in fairly a few dodgy black dictators, very radicalised, very angry black people, the Organisation of African Unity, some of them rather better than some of the others. It did all become a bit of a tangle, didn't it?
Yes, no, definitely. Definitely, but I think it was the times. I mean, really driven by the times of what are you standing up for, you know, searching for this identity. And there weren't that many black voices, people being outspoken about blackness, or there was a drive towards it. And she, coming from Africa, took a stand. And that was also, you know, that was asserting her Africanness and her blackness and proud to be black. I think that was the whole period. But I think as she got older, then you temper it down. You start to see that it's not, you know, a colour thing.
Kate, she got involved with Paul Simon.
Yes.
In the production of Graceland. And that involved her cooperating with Paul Simon, who went to South Africa with the cooperation of the South African authorities. And it was easy to tar it with a brush of being actually collaborating with the apartheid regime. And she was criticised for that. Rightly, do you think?
No, I don't think she was. I think what Paul Simon did with Graceland was, again, it was a sort of another layer of opening up South Africa to a wider audience, opening up South African music to a wider audience. I mean, you know, groups like Ladysmith Black Mambazo got huge success because of the Graceland project. And I think this was, in a way, I suppose, I wouldn't have criticised her, couldn't have criticised her, all that Paul Simon project, because what he did in a much grander, greater way than I was kind of the same as what I did. You know, you can shut away these regimes and let them get on with it themselves. Or you can blow open the door and say, this is what's happening. And as I say, I didn't really have anybody to tell, but at least I went and found out for myself what was going on there.
Can I put to both of you a hard question? World music, ambassadress for the black masses, the Click song, Mama Africa, Paul Simon, it's lovely stuff. Bringing the sound and feeling of Africa to a big new worldwide audience, who can deplore it? But starting with that voice, that timing, that ability to project intimacy. She could have been a great jazz singer. She could have been a Billie Holiday. She could have been a Nina Simone. She could have been a great jazz-edged pop singer. She could have been a Dionne Warwick, an Aretha Franklin, an Elkie Brooks, a Joan Armatrading. Trading. She could have interpreted other people's songs, moved her music forward. She could have married African music to bigger traditions. Instead, she never really developed. She got herself a familiar, much-loved repertoire, and she stuck to it. I've got no problems with her unsteady political judgment. Who cares? She was a singer. No problems with her bizarre matrimonial life. It all sounds quite fun. But I do have a problem with Miriam Makeba's failure to develop her talents, the way she put herself in a niche and stayed there. I put it to you, Kate, that she got musically lazy.
Oh, it's a good job I'm not going to throw this glass of water at you. I think of Miriam Makeba, and maybe this is wrong of me, maybe I've put her in a box that I shouldn't do, but I think of Miriam Makeba first and foremost as a South African woman who sung about South Africa. And she sung the songs that she'd grown up with. She sung about a life that she had been forcibly removed from, or wasn't allowed back to anyway. Her music was her connection to her home when she wasn't allowed to go back to that home. You're right, her voice is astonishing. Her musical ability is astonishing. But why did she need to be another Nina Simone or Billie Holiday? Why couldn't she just be Miriam Makeba singing songs that nobody else was singing? No one else can sing the click song. No one else can sing the patter patter song. Only her. And yes, it might be a narrow repertoire. Yeah, she might not be known throughout the world for being one of the great black singers, but to me, she will be always Mama Africa, and there's no one like her.
Yeah.
I would just like you to listen to a snatch of Back of the Moon, as I first heard it when I was really only a boy. She was only, I think, 26 or 27 when she sung this, and I still, in my heart, wish that the woman who could sing this at 26 or 27 had done even more musically.
Like a bing-bong ball down a mountain stream, like paper riding in the breeze, like strolling in the dark through streets you know. People can feel free as these people being what they please. People being easy, letting go, letting go, letting go.
Her first name was not Miriam, it was Zenzile. Zenzile means you have no one to blame but yourself. Do you think, Kate, that Miriam Makeba did break the fetters of her destiny?
Yes, I think she did. I think, you know, her destiny could have been that she became your nanny, or another cleaning lady in South Africa who could sing while she mopped the floor. And instead, she was a force to be reckoned with, both musically and politically. And she was a person who made an awful lot of people fall in love with her for all the right reasons. And I think that's the thing I admire more than anything else, is that this woman dragged herself out of a township, out of poverty, and not only looked after herself, but looked after her nation and did it very effectively.
You've been listening to Great Lives. My thanks to my guest, Kate Humble, who chose Miriam Makeba, and to our expert witness, Nomsa Mwamuka. Goodbye.